From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Utah State Senator Stuart Adams has said recently a ballot initiative where citizens collect signatures to change something is just not a good way to make laws. It's clunky, it's rigid, it's hard to know whether the citizens signing the petition really know that much about the issue or the consequences if it passes. Elected representatives, he said, are just better at solving problems. But what if lawmakers are not responding to the concerns of citizens? What if the majority of citizens don't agree with lawmakers on something, like medical marijuana or education funding? Then what do you do? Well, it's not easy to get a law on the ballot if you're a citizens group, but for various reasons, more and more are trying to bypass lawmakers and go directly to voters. So today in the program, we're talking about all of this. Join us after the news.
This week on 45 Days, a good old-fashioned sex scandal hits the state capitol. Utah wants to host the Olympics again, and lawmakers ditch a bill to tweak the state's surrogacy law. We'll also hear from Representative Kim Coleman of West Jordan. I'm Nicole Nixon. Join me and Julia Ritchie for the next episode of 45 Days. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. American citizens supposedly worked out the way we wanted to handle lawmaking early on. I guess our common consent was that we would have a representative democracy. That is, we would vote for leaders and trust they would do our will. And, of course, the legwork, all of that required. You know, work out the budget numbers, the consequences of laws. We figured that they would work out the bugs and fine-tune the problems. But what happens if lawmakers just don't agree with citizens on something? In fact, let me say that again. What happens if lawmakers don't agree with a majority of citizens on something? What do you do then? Well, in states around the country, there is an option of collecting signatures to get something on the ballot. It has various names. Direct democracy is one of them. Take the issue of medical marijuana. It, of course, is fraught with all kinds of complications, and lawmakers in Utah are naturally cautious about it. In fact, if you polled them right now, they would probably not be in support of allowing it in the state. But if you poll rank-and-file Utahns, something like 76% are for it. So where does that leave you? And the same kind of fact pattern is at play in a number of other citizens' initiatives this year. So all of that is giving us an opportunity to talk about direct democracy, how it works or doesn't or should. Robert Gerke is back with us, news columnist, of course, for the Salt Lake Tribune. He has been writing about this. Last week he wrote a piece about lawmakers and their response to ballot initiatives. And thanks for joining us again.
Yeah, thank you.
And David Magleby is back with us, of course, a professor of political science at Brigham Young University, specializes in American government. He's the author of the book Direct Legislation, which looks at ballot propositions in the United States. And the professor's joining us today from KBYU in Provo. And Professor, welcome back to you.
Good to be with you.
Okay, so I wanted to play a clip. This is from there was a media availability. I think this was last week, February 5th, I think it was. Is that right, Robert?
That sounds right.
Something like that. And Stuart Adams, who's the whip in
the Senate majority whip in the Senate,
was asked about these citizens' initiatives. And I think his answer is a good jumping off point for some of this conversation. Let's hear from Senator Stuart Adams.
It seems to always amaze me that I can come up with the best idea that I can possibly come up with, introduce it into a bill, and then through this 45-day sifting period, by the time my colleagues look at it and other interests look at it, it gets changed and sometimes changed significantly, and it always becomes better. The initiative process doesn't allow that. Somebody come up with a really good idea, it sits on the ballot, and it has most of the good ideas, even all of us come up with, have unintended consequences. And some of them on the initiative process are unconstitutional, we think anyway, perhaps. And so the initiative process, I suppose, is a great process, but by far the better process is the legislative process. And I think we probably will do better at solving some of these problems.
Okay, so does that, do you think, Robert, essentially lay out the way most lawmakers think about this process?
Yeah, I think it does. And I don't think he's wrong necessarily. I mean, I think there are some strengths to the legislative process in that they do get to refine the language of it and, you know, work out potential problems. The becomes better, you know, it always becomes better, he says, is a little bit of a relative term,
yeah.
Right?
Because and a subjective
It's a subjective
concept,
term.
Yeah.
Like what's the goal? Is the goal to come up with a law that works, which it should be, or is the goal to come up with something that represents the will of the voters, the people they represent? And I think what we've seen is that by going through this legislative process, this refining process, what they've ended up with is something that doesn't satisfy voters' wishes and desires. And so, you know, as it has been the case in this country for a long time, the initiative is sort of the outlet, sort of that sort of Damocles, I guess, that hangs over their head. And you know, voters are taking it into their own hands to get these things done that they want done. And yeah, they haven't seen the response that they want from their legislative officials.
David Magleby, just on the basic point, is the initiative process not a great way to make laws, as Senator Adams says?
Well, it has strengths and weaknesses. It does permit, as Robert said, for an outlet, and that, I think, is an important strength of it. With respect to what Senator Adams said, with respect saying that things being done by initiative may be unconstitutional, that's true. The courts are the traffic cop of the initiative process, but I would add many of the actions of the state legislature end up going to court as well, and some of those are declared unconstitutional as well. So both processes are subject to a judicial check. The key difference is the origin. Is the origin through the state legislature, or is the origin through a petition process instigated by citizens?
So I wanted to get a sense. David Magleby, tell us, just philosophically, where does the idea of direct democracy, the idea of a citizen comes up with an idea who is in conflict with their lawmaker, getting a petition, going around, collecting all these signatures, how does that square with the way the founders, the framers of the Constitution, the way they were working out how this process was supposed to work?
Well, they were aware of this kind of process from the Greek city-state, specifically Athens, and Madison specifically warns the country against too much democracy and too much of this kind of democracy, voting by the people. They were also familiar with it, and it became very much an institution in New England with the town meeting, where there's not a city council, there's a town council, and everybody who's a voter can vote. And that has worked in small towns with very widespread participation, everyone being a legislator. But political theorists have long argued there's a problem of size. I mean, once it gets to be larger than a small town, it becomes unwieldy.
I wonder, are we in a different place now? When you think about the information era, the information age, where you have far more convenience in engaging citizens and putting out information, gathering, you know, the whole idea of crowdsourcing ideas and innovation, are we in a different stage? And should we be thinking about the direct democracy in a new or a different way? Is this maybe not as clunky as it has been in the past, given the options for, you know, fine-tuning this process at some point?
With the internet and social media, 24/7 news, you'd assume voters would be in a much better position. The problem with that thinking is that voters are busy people. They've got a lot of things going on in their lives. And these initiative votes are simultaneous with the votes for state legislature, for U.S. Senate, for congressional districts in Utah this year. And so there's an information overload for many voters. And then the next thing is not all voters are equally skilled or adept or educated enough to be able to function in what is a very complicated process of figuring out a yes and no vote on as many as five ballot initiatives.
Yeah, we'll get into that as we go along. What do you think about that? That we're now in maybe we're in an era where we should be rethinking. I mean, it seemed like in the past, I think the people look at, and we'll get into this as we go, something like Prop 13 in California, mm-hmm. which there's an argument that putting in the hands of voters the idea of whether their taxes should be raised to pay for education, higher yeah. education. When you did that, you basically decimated their state education system, and it was destroyed it.
Yeah.
And so that was a bad – but are we in a new era where maybe we're more enlightened or more in more educated about these things? According to the professor, maybe not.
Yeah. And California is such an interesting example because they have so many of these, so many initiatives every time you go to the ballot. They have these ballots that, you know, read like giant restaurant menus. They go on for pages because they have Professor Magleby may know the actual number, but I think it was over 200 initiatives on their last election, and some of them were directly contradictory of each other, and they both passed. And so it's sort of, you know, it has the potential to be a complete mess. We haven't seen that problem necessarily here in Utah in the past, but these issues are very complicated. There are a lot of moving parts. Even the proponents of say the medical marijuana initiative here recognize and acknowledge that after it passes, because they think it's going to pass, that the legislature may have to come back and do some fine tuning to make it something that can be implemented, in the way that they envision. These ballot initiatives, some of them read for 20, 25 pages, you know, of code, you know, and it's written in a very technical way. And it affects other sections of code. So it is complicated. But I think, you know, you take the step back and, you know, do voters want, say, medical marijuana in Utah? And as we've seen across the country, voters overwhelmingly do want that. And they do here as well. And so, can voters appreciate all the nuance of an issue, all the intricacies of how it's going to affect different sections of code and administrative rules and all of that? Probably not, but I think they have. I think in the larger scheme of things, they have a sense of what they want, and they want to see their legislators do it. And when their legislators don't do it, again, as we said at the outset, they take it into their own hands. And this is sort of the only tool that they have to do that. They, you know, maybe it would be better if there was some way that they could do, you know, like Senator Adams says, refine the legislation or refine the proposal a little bit. But it's impractical to do it that way. And so this is what we're left with.
Professor Magleby, am I oversimplifying the California example? I think there is some argument that putting this decision, for example, higher education, in the hands of California citizens did some damage. But I'm not sure if I'm overstating that.
No, I think the consensus of people who've studied Proposition 13 would be consistent with your statement, Doug. Just to add a little bit to this sort of classic case of direct legislation of California, that state permits voters to not only put statutes on the ballot, but also to put constitutional amendments on the ballot. Yeah. So not surprisingly, lots of groups decide if we're going to have to pay to get signatures, which they do and which they also do in Utah, we might as well go to the Constitution. Then it's going to be harder to change. So one of the reasons that, as Robert indicated, there are lots of ballot measures every time you vote in California, that's because to change an old initiative from 20, 40, or 60 years ago, you're going to have to vote on the amendment to that constitutional initiative that was passed previously. So it makes the public in some ways much more of a legislature. I have friends in California who vote early by mail ballot, and they sort of sit down and study five or six initiatives every night for a couple, you know, for 10 days, and then they've done their work. But not many voters are willing to invest that amount of time. The other difference about California that could happen in Utah or other states if they become more initiative prone is that you start voting on these in primaries. So many states, Utah included, would only permit this in a general election. But in California, they're on the ballot both in primary elections and in general elections. It was no coincidence that former Utah and Howard Jarvis, who was the author of Proposition 13, chose to put the ballot measure Prop 13 on in a June primary. And by so doing, he identified an election when there would be relatively few voters who would be anti-tax cut and more voters who would be pro-tax cut because of the other races that would be on that ballot. So there's a lot of strategy that goes into the timing in California because it can be both a primary or a general election vote.
Robert, you've mentioned in your writing how unusual this year seems to be in some ways. We haven't had an initiative on the ballot since I think it was 2007.
Yeah, and in 2007 we had a referendum to repeal the school vouchers bill that the legislature passed, and that that referendum to repeal that voucher law passed by a pretty convincing margin. And since then, I guess the nice part about that is since then legislators have been reluctant to go back and deal with the voucher issue
because they got the point.
They got the point.
Yeah.
They got the message from voters. Before that, I think it was 2003. I mean, it's exceptional.
Five in 20 years, I think you said,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's exceptionally rare for us to have these here because the process, they've made it so difficult to get them on. It takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of signatures. You've got to gather 113,000 signatures right now across the state. You know, they have to be geographically dispersed, a percentage of in each county. And so it becomes a pretty lofty task. And so the other thing that it—
But
it,
wait, but we have six this year.
Yeah.
So what gives? What's different?
Well, I think, in my opinion, I think it's the frustration that the legislature has failed to address these issues. They've had years to address things like school funding. And now we see in this one, the school funding one in particular, is being backed by local business leaders. You know, they are saying that we're not getting the types of employees out of our schools that we need. And to, you know, maintain the long-term economic prosperity that we have, we need better educated workers. And so that's where that one's coming from. I mean, medical marijuana has been debated up at the legislature for 2 or 3 years now. And, you know, and finally they're just, you know, after last session they'd had enough and they said, you know, we're not going to get what we want from the legislature. So, you know, they have some, I think, largely out of state financial interests that are putting some money behind this. But they also have a lot of grassroots support for this. And so, you know, they've gathered, from my understanding, over 100,000 signatures already. So they're well on their way to getting there. The Count My Vote initiative, they started that one a few years ago. And in 2014, they reached a deal with the legislature to kind of, you know, shelve that one for the time being. The leaders of that one feel like the legislature didn't necessarily honor the agreement they made, or at least in the House side, they've been trying to undermine that agreement. And so they're bringing it back and saying, okay, we're going all the way this time. And again, that one comes from, it's backed by business and political leaders in the state. And so I think it's just, yeah, there's just sort of a bottleneck, a frustration, and it's sort of leading to this grassroots movement.
David Magalby, take us back, if you would, to the tax revolt. This was in the, I guess it was in the 80s, was it not? Or was it in, yeah.
Prop 13 was 78.
Yeah.
June of 78, and then it spread by fall of 78 to several other states. Michigan, Massachusetts was a state that had been voting on taxes. It joined in. It had a profound national impact, even though it was only in one state initially. And launched, if you will, some of the groundswell that helped elect Ronald Reagan president in 1980. So everybody understands, I think, nationally that these votes, even if it's only in one or two states, can start to set a movement afoot nationwide. Mm-hmm. And medical marijuana is not a bad example of that. Legislatures had been resistant to doing it. Groups like those in Utah decided this was important. It was a popular issue. They had to have had some backing. Could have been individuals. Could have been groups. But the key is to win in the first state, and then you send a signal to people in other states. But you also can have an effect on state legislatures.
Yeah.
Because they say, the mood of the people is to cut taxes. And so one of the profound elements of Prop 13 was that it encouraged legislatures to go on a tax-cutting binge. And so these votes can be quite important.
We should remind people, maybe they'll remember this, Republican Governor Norm Bangeter raised taxes to pay for education. And in response, there was a Utah tax revolt and an attempt at an initiative. Remind
us three,
of that.
Doug.
Yeah.
There were
three,
actually three
right.
measures.
Right. Yeah.
And Merrill Cook was the most best known of the group leading the tax revolt in Utah. Many people assumed that this was politically unwise of Governor Bangeter to do what he did. But I think he saw in many ways a similar kind of thing to what's happening behind the sales tax increase for public education now. He saw Utah's demographic reality as meaning we had to dig a little deeper in our pockets to educate our kids. But it was politically risky. And a bipartisan coalition arose to challenge these tax-cutting measures, headed by Warren Pugh, a state senator, and Scott Matheson, Sr. And by and large, you know, amazing to many, they were able to prevail. The voters did not vote to cut their taxes in Utah, even though those tax cut initiatives would have allowed them to. It became something of a national bellwether in the reverse direction of Prop 13.
What does it say about, and I use this word advisedly, the wisdom of crowds? That they'll figure this out and do the right thing, the responsible thing, or that in some ways they may act like a mob from time to time and do the impulsive thing?
Well, the answer is it depends on the campaign. We're talking about the process in Utah right now at the beginning stages, which is the petitioning stage. And here the petitioners are going to tell the voters, let the voters decide, just sign this. Don't you want the voters to decide these issues? And they're actually circulating them in bundles of three or so. And many a petition signer won't even read what they're signing. The face-to-face request from a person is hard to say no to. While it's expensive because very few volunteers are willing to risk the rejection, with money you can get people to sign petitions that often they won't even read. That gets you to the ballot, but then the key issue is defining the issue for the voters.
Yeah.
And as Robert said a moment ago, it won't be the 20 pages of statutory language written by lawyers as if they worked for the state legislature, but in fact they're in law firms somewhere else in the state or the country. Then there's the short title that's given to the measure. So Count My Vote is not the official title that'll appear on the petition or on the ballot. But it's a way to try and define the issue by the proponents. But just as the proponents will try and define the issue favorably to get people to vote for it on Election Day, the opponents are going to do everything they can to get people to vote against it in their campaign, which often will result in arguments that are somewhat spurious but may confuse the voters or scare the voters with the objective of getting people to vote no when they're in doubt.
And is that a de facto vote for most people that they would just as soon, if they have some uncertainty, they'll opt for the no?
Yes. It's a status quo orientation that voters understandably have. And these are, again, voters who are busy people.
Yep.
They don't have time to read the voter guide. And by the way, even if they did, it's not very readable. And so they're gonna pay attention to the TV ads. They're going to pay attention to the mail they've received, some of which will be highly negative, just as we see in candidate races. In fact, often it's even more scary or even more negative.
And just on that point, I've heard from people who are, you know, organizing against some of these initiatives that they're not planning necessarily to run against one initiative or another. They're planning to run against the whole bundle of initiatives. We don't want things to go this way in Utah. We don't want to become California, right? So they're going to run against all of them in that regard, and then hope, I guess, as David mentioned, that the default is we're going to vote no, right? And if there's uncertainty, then they can derail some of these, if not all of them, with sort of a groundswell of support for the status quo.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Lisa, who is in Salt Lake City, I guess, up at Capitol Hill. That's what it says here. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you, Doug.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, I've worked on probably as many initiatives in the state as the attorney on those projects as anyone in Utah. I worked on English only, this tax reform rings true, redistricting reform, and radioactive waste. And all of those initiatives had a daunting process, a hurdle that is insurmountable for someone to get on the ballot. What is so fascinating on the statement from Stuart Adams with regard to we have a process that refines. They have 1,390 bills at the legislature this session. When I was an attorney there, they had 400, and that was unwieldy for staff at that time.
Wow.
But this redistricting reform, when we did it 10 years ago, it didn't make it to the ballot. What happened, though, is that somebody in the House tried to get it out of rules every year for 7-8 years and finally just said, they're not going to let it out of rules. Now, what redistricting was meant to do and is designed to do in other states and has been successful in doing that is to reform the process of apportionment. Therefore, gerrymandering couldn't be done anymore in these states. In California and in Oregon, they have a very good process that's working. And our legislation started, and they've used that same bill to get it out of the House and get it on the ballot this year. So my point is that, no, the legislature is very jealous of its territory. They want the jurisdiction as the only body that can legislate. But the Constitution of the state of Utah says it's a co-equal power between the citizenry and the legislature.
I want to get some reaction to that. Robert, you start. I mean, this idea that a lot of these initiatives, these ideas, end up bound up in rules. They don't get out. It's a wieldy process. They're, as she said, dealing with hundreds, if not a thousand bills.
Yeah, I mean, there has been a huge increase in the number of bills that are sponsored. And it doesn't take much. It's very easy to stop a bill during this process, especially if you just need the right person in the right position, and bills can disappear overnight. And so getting something like this, that's another thing that's probably noteworthy in this whole discussion, is all of these are sort of have a populist bent to them, right? And so getting something like that through the Utah legislature is pretty difficult. I think there's also, and we can talk about this in greater detail, but I think because of the way our legislature is structured with the delegate system, most of these legislators are more accountable to the delegates of their respective ledge districts and their parties than they are the broader populace, then it's easier to block things up, and it's harder to get things moving because they don't necessarily have to worry about answering to voters in November. They just have to worry about answering to their delegates when they go to the convention. So I think it does make it a lot easier to hold these things up. She mentioned several examples of things that have been blocked over the years, and we've seen, again, as we talked about some of these, the school funding, the medical marijuana, the Medicaid expansion is one that had got talked about for years before they finally said, okay, we're done talking at the Capitol. We're going to take this into our own hands. And so I think she's absolutely right that there is sort of an inherent bias at the Utah Capitol toward do nothing, you know. This maybe is the only way to get things moving. And if nothing else, even if we get to November and these initiatives don't pass, I think they have, you know, we've seen this session, they've turned the heat up on the legislature to start taking this seriously and start appreciating that there is a public outcry for this.
What about the constitutional element that Lisa mentioned, David Magleby, that the Utah Constitution takes into account something like this, that this is, as she said, is she right about that?
She is. But in some ways, the legislature, as Robert said, has over time made this process more difficult. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that's been challenged in court. It could be, and it would be an interesting challenge over how much constraint you can put on voters, that is the legislature constraining direct legislation. Lisa made a very good point, Doug. She identified, I think, the strongest or one of the strongest arguments for the process. There are some issues in which the legislature is protecting its own interests. And when that's the case, they are in a conflict of interest with the public in some ways. And the redistricting one is a really good example because they get to draw their own boundaries, yeah. And they have been. And Utah is a classic case of a partisan gerrymander. And they get to keep doing it as long as they're in office. And unless something like this initiative happens, that probability of partisan gerrymandering will be high again in 2021 and 2022. Similarly, they care a lot about their nomination process, which is why they like the convention system. Yeah. That's how they got there. Yeah. And so it's threatening to them to take away the power to draw the district boundaries and place it in some other process more neutral and quote-unquote fair, or to take away the process by which they got nominated. That's why they are such intense fighting on those two measures. And Robert maybe can tell us about this sixth measure, the Allow the Caucus and Convention Method for Party Nominations initiative. That feels like a counter initiative to me, trying to counter the Count My Vote.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly where that's coming from. It's the people, the defenders of the convention system.
The Republican Party.
The Republican delegates, by and large, and they see this as a way that they can maybe, turn back the Count My Vote initiative effort. And the way that works is basically, you know, because they are directly contradictory to each other, whichever one ends up getting the most votes is the one that becomes law. And I think Dave's point is right on about the legislature doesn't want to give up the control. I mean, I think we maybe have all experienced something like this. If you're the one who likes to drive the car, you don't like to sit in the passenger seat while somebody else drives because you think you can do it better. And so we're seeing, you know, a little bit of a tussle to try to take the wheel on this, I think.
But how much of this is citizens' fault in this sense? I think you mentioned answering to voters in November, but Utah's essentially, in some aspects, certainly in a lot of these legislative races, basically a one-party state. There's no answering to voters. For the most part, lawmakers can, in some ways, act with impunity. At least that's some argument. So, because the de facto vote for a lot of Utahns is just, well, I may not like them in these ways, but I'm not going to vote for a Democrat, so they vote for a Republican, even if they call themselves independent.
Right, and in the overwhelming number of these legislative races, you get to November, there's really not a race. Often there's not a candidate. If there is a candidate, it's not competitive. I think we've talked about before on this show where somewhere between 5 and 10 races out of the 104 legislative races every election are actually competitive. And so really all you have to worry about is keeping your partisan delegates or your your own people, your own base happy because we kind of touch on this with the redistricting initiative. Most of these districts are drawn in such a way right now that they're not competitive. All the Democrats are – and it's both sides. The Democratic districts are strongly Democratic. The Republican districts are strongly Republican. And there's a very narrow road in the middle where people actually have to worry about what their voters think of them, right? And so, that's where this redistricting initiative, I think, could actually change the dynamic, change the landscape a little bit if it passes, because you could start seeing more representatives having to be accountable to their voters in November and having to worry a little bit more about being responsive to the voters' wishes. Maybe that releases some of the pressure that we saw build up that led to some of these initiatives.
A lot of comments coming, or a number of them anyway, related to this gerrymandering issue. Dixie, and I should mention Dixie's with the Utah Citizens Council, writes that the Better Boundaries Initiative, which she supports, this is to establish an independent redistricting commission, just so you know. She said, it's been written with extremely knowledgeable legal help and with information from well-informed sources who are aware of the ill effects for democracy of Utah's gerrymandering. In other words, saying that, look, these aren't just dopes who are putting together these initiatives, that they're written with legal consult, and it's not just this impulsive citizen. I mean, I think that's the point that she's making. Keith writes that the most important process for lawmaking is the proposition process, because lawmakers, for a variety of reasons, don't always listen to regular folks. And fortunately, the law impedes citizens from submitting illegal laws. So at least that's the perspective of Keith. This from Jay: it appears to me that the reason for Utah's ballot initiatives is because of the extensive partisan gerrymandering that prevents citizens from electing those who reflect their views. It's something that I think you both expressed, at least something that's going on there. We'll take a break and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking the question, what do you do if you want a bill passed, but the legislature doesn't? Can you, should you get it done yourself, like with an initiative? There are six petitions this year to bypass lawmakers and get something done. Medical marijuana is one. Nearly 80% of Utahns want some kind of bill. So far, lawmakers don't really. Also, education funding, same thing, and redistricting, the same thing. So we're talking about this process of ballot initiatives and the role they play in the process with David Magleby. He's a professor of political science at Brigham Young University. He specializes in this particular issue. Also, he's written a book about it called Direct Legislation. It looks at the ballot propositions in the United States. He's joining us from KBYU in Provo. And we have Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune, a columnist for the the paper, has been looking into all of this. He's joining us here in the studio. Let's go back to the phones. Ash is with us in Salt Lake, I think. Ash, welcome.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for taking my call. This is a great show so far.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, I just was wondering if the guests would like to comment on, you spoke earlier about the role of the crowd, the wisdom of the crowd, and why we have such a sudden rush of initiatives. And I was wondering if we would talk a little bit about the public's awareness of special interests and the role they play in legislation, specifically the American Legislative Exchange Council, the right-wing think tank, and if maybe that has something to do with what's going on right now.
What do you mean? In what way would that have something to do with what's going on right now? Just clarify that if you
would.
Well,
for instance, the American Legislative Exchange Council is a national organization that helps write legislation for state legislatures.
Yeah.
And we know that many of our legislators are members of that, and that we know of many bills that are involved come from them. And I think that maybe in the last year or so, we've seen a rush of awareness about the role of money in politics. It was a huge issue.
So you're seeing these initiatives as kind of a reaction to that, as a counter to that. Is that what you're saying? You're wondering?
I think that it could be. Yeah, it could play a big role in why we're seeing so many people willing to, put out all the time and effort and money to bypass what they may, maybe there's a greater sentiment that they aren't being necessarily represented the way that they used to.
What do you think, Robert? It's interesting.
I think there's two sides to that coin. I think on one hand, we've seen bills in the Utah legislature and elsewhere that are aimed at making it more difficult for this direct process, this initiative process. And we've seen some legislation, I think, that maybe has stymied some progress on some of these issues. A lot of these, when we're talking about these six in particular, a lot of them are more dealing with the process of electing people. So they're not necessarily reflective, I don't think, of sort of the big ALEC money that comes in, the Koch brothers money and so forth. The other side of that coin, though, I think that, we talk about these as grassroots and citizen-driven and things like that, and to a large degree they are, but it also takes an awful lot of money. As David mentioned earlier, it's a couple million bucks to get these things on the ballot, and that doesn't come from, $5 or $10 donations. You usually need some sort of well-heeled business interest that wants to get these through, and we've seen it in other states as well. Where, for example, it was in Washington State, I believe, that Walmart, passed an initiative that allows wine in grocery stores because they wanted to be able to sell wine. So you can get this coming the other way too, where it's not citizen driven, where it's actually corporate driven. The medical marijuana initiative that has a lot of money coming in from medical marijuana interests around the country. It's not all coming in from these patients. And these patients, they do tell heartbreaking stories, and they say they would benefit from this, and that's sort of the impetus of this. But they're not going to be able to do this all on their own.
David Magalby, what do you think?
Well, for two points. One on the broader point that we were talking about before of the legislature and responsiveness. What we have in a one-party state like Utah is a legislature that can and often is susceptible to influence by factions, some of them well-funded outside of the state even. And that process is acute at the convention and caucus system, as Utah learned in the 2010 instance with Bob Bennett. Being attacked by FreedomWorks and Club for Growth. And that really is the initiation of this battle that we're going to maybe see culminate in 2018 with the Count My Vote versus the Allow the Citizen Convention method folks. With respect to money and initiatives, Robert is exactly right. In these days, it's sort of naive to assume that you're going to get something on the ballot just through volunteers. Therefore, you need money to get on the ballot. But that's just the start. Then we launch the campaign phase in which we're trying to inform, educate, and persuade voters. And here's where money can really matter a lot because well-funded opposition groups especially are able to successfully redefine the measure from what the original intent may have been to something very different. So, for example, a friend of mine didn't like smoke in restaurants. In California, he and others sponsored the Clean Indoor Air Initiative. They were very brave. They had some support from the American Cancer Society. But then when Big Tobacco came in, it just overwhelmed them. And so when organized interests are threatened by one of these, the intensity of the no campaign is amazing and often prevails.
If I could just elaborate a little bit on the money that comes into these. We'd mentioned in 2007 there was a referendum to repeal the school voucher law. That money, that wouldn't have – there were two things that had going for it. One is UEA was behind it and has this network all across the state of all of these teachers that could go out and gather these signatures. The signature gathering companies were not really what they are today at that point. And so they were able to do that with sort of that grassroots network. But then the NEA, the National Education Association, poured millions of dollars into this to get this repealed. And I believe it was something like $5 million that they spent nationally, and then there was a couple million locally. It was big money. And so, you know, again, there was a grassroots network there, but this was not a solely grassroots movement to try to repeal that. And so I think you're seeing sort of that similar, you know, you're seeing both of these play out in some of these other initiatives as well.
Robert, you mentioned that a lot of these initiatives have a populist flavor to them.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, they also seem like they have a progressive sentiment to them too. I mean, medical marijuana,
yeah.
Count my vote, you know, even the gerrymandering that seems to have a progressive sort of political bent to it. Medicaid expansion, of course.
Very much so, yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I think that's, as David mentioned, we're in a one-party state, a very conservative one-party state, and a state where the elected representatives are even more conservative typically than the people they're representing. And so, you know, again, these are things that the legislature, because of that very conservative, you know, ideology, has been unwilling to move on. And so the people who are a little bit maybe more the medical marijuana one, it's even hard to call progressive now.
True.
Because so many states have done it. And there's such and as the recent poll that the Tribune did showed, it's supported both by Democrats and Republicans. 76% statewide support the medical marijuana initiative. So that one's a little hard to call progressive. You're absolutely right about the Medicaid expansion, and we've seen popular support for that in poll after poll after poll. I guess we have to be a little cautious with polls, because polls are blunt instruments. We ask a yes or no question.
True.
Just like you do when you're doing an initiative. And so, and so, you know, we don't get into the nuance that we talked about, the 25 pages, and we don't couch it in sort of that way. But yeah, I think in every one of these cases, there's popular support for it. So it's a populist movement, but also, yes, they're a little bit more progressive than the legislature's been willing to be.
So, Professor, is it possible that initiatives like this, if we're going to see more of them, could have a direct impact on the political landscape of the Utah legislature, make some lawmakers a little bit more accountable to more moderate voters? Do you see that as a possibility?
Yes. And the answer is definitive, because three of them have to do with how they get there. And so if they were to change the process, making the nomination phase more open and letting a broader cross-section of Republicans and Democrats choose who is running for the state legislature or the U.S. Senate, that almost certainly will lead to a different kind of candidate in at least some instances than the current much more closed, higher cost of involvement. It takes a lot of time to be a delegate. Most people don't want to invest that much time. And there's an argument that maybe that's what we should have. I'm aware of those arguments. But the in terms of representation of people's points of view, the caucus and convention system doesn't do very well. And so this would change that. And then I think the redistricting initiative, which would substitute the legislature for the legislature a more neutral and quote-unquote fair process. And I think the group in Utah that's been studying this has been involved in studying it very carefully, looking at what works and doesn't work in other states. Justice Brandeis once said that states are laboratories of democracy.
Yeah.
One of the advantages of the initiative is that you can identify other states that have gone ahead. Arizona, for example, has a redistricting commission. Iowa. And I think the group in Utah has, as I'm confident, studied that and integrated that into their proposal. But the opposition will be intense in the election period.
I'm looking at an outline for your book. Professor, and there are these questions that you raise. You know, who participates and why? Those are big. But also, to what extent do voters understand the propositions they're deciding? How do voters learn about them? What factors are important in their choices? And I wonder what kind of conclusions you've drawn from that, whether or not – I don't know how to put this – you can trust citizens to make these informed decisions.
Well, it is a more complicated process for a voter than voting for a member of Congress or the state legislature because the political parties are not involved in sending cues or signals to voters in most instances. Voters are therefore more on their own. Therefore, this process is more geared towards highly educated, highly motivated voters who take the time to study and learn what a yes and a no vote is. Some voters will simply say it's just too complicated. And so as we were talking about that California case earlier where there are scores of measures on a given ballot, they will quit voting on some of them. There's just ballot fatigue, Doug. Mm-hmm. In the old days when they had to do it in the booth, I was once on the Today Show with Bryant Gumbel about this very topic, and voters were supposed to finish voting in 10 minutes. Well, it was virtually impossible for a voter to do that because there were 36 measures, not counting local measures, on the ballot that year in California.
Wow.
Think about voting on 36, not 6.
Yeah.
So while this is a big surge in Utah, this would be a vacation in California.
I think there's a presumption here that lawmakers are actually reading all of these bills too. Here's a comment from Caleb who writes, as an attorney, I find that a majority of statutes that I research for my cases pass their committees and the House and the Senate floor with no comment, no discussion, or amendments. Senator Adams comments, Caleb writes, about how well the legislative process works is putting lipstick on a pig. Those parties, he says, improves his initial bill drafts are really just special interests that have special access to legislators for the purpose of getting what they want, not necessarily what we all want or need.
Well, it puts a greater onus on you, Doug, and on Robert as well. The people in the media have a larger responsibility when it comes to informing the voters, encouraging debate and discussion, not the TV ads and the mailers that are arriving in your mailbox, but a good pro-con debate on all five of these needs to happen within a week or so of the election, before the election. And perhaps before the early ballots are mailed out, because voters need information here even more than they need it when they're voting for president, Senate, governor, Congress, and so forth.
You want to say anything about that last comment?
Well, I think Caleb makes a pretty good point, actually. You go to some of these legislative hearings, and they feel oftentimes that they're strictly just to check the box, right? They have to have a hearing on the bill. They're going to, you know, take a few comments from the public. But the real work of putting these bills together is already done. And if there are changes to it, it's oftentimes because some interest or another has a lobbyist up there who's able to get this, you know, help shape the bill. So, yeah, I mean it's an interesting point because you know, Senator Adams talks about the refining process and the input that goes into it. Well, the public's not necessarily having the input that they would like to have on that. And if they were, we probably wouldn't be where we are right now.
There's a comment from David who writes, I've been involved in the initiative process. I've also been a legislator, and the arrogance of those who denigrate the voice of the people, he says, is breathtaking. It all comes down to who shall ultimately be in charge. Senator Adams and his friends simply feel they know best, therefore they should be in charge. That presumption should be offensive to everyone else. The legislative process, he writes, in a one-party state is not a great model or font of wisdom. We have Robert Gerke with us from the Salt Lake Tribune. We have David Magleby, who teaches political science at Brigham Young University, with us. We need to take another quick break, and we'll come back for some final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about these ballot initiatives, how they work or should work. David Magleby is with us, teaches political science at Brigham Young University. Robert Gerke, a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, also with us. So, Robert, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, there are a couple of you were talking to me off the air about the fact that there are a few things in the pipeline or some organizations looking to see what happens here. Not that we're headed towards 30 initiatives right. like California, but where are we headed in this?
Well, I think there are some people watching this, and I've heard some talk up at the Capitol of people. Future initiatives that are already kind of like watching how these play out, a right to die initiative perhaps, or a liquor reform initiative, because once again, the legislature has not moved in a way that a large portion of the public wants. I think they have to wait and see, because the legislature's made this incredibly difficult to get on the ballot. And we talked about the 113,000 signatures they need all across the state. And so, how these play out, I think, will be a harbinger, I guess, for what we might see in 2020 and beyond.
David Magleby, is this a moment? Are we having a moment? Does this seem important? Are we going to see more of these kinds of things?
Oh, I think it's clearly a moment. I mean, we did have those three Cook tax initiatives, but they were all together, one team sort of instigating and campaigning.
Yeah.
So the number here and the variety, while there are similarities across the issues, suggests that this is a bit of a moment. The issue that's missing that I think would fit with these and could be a future initiative beyond those Robert mentioned would be something about clean air, pollution. Mm-hmm. Which is an issue that lots and lots of people care about in Utah. There have been organized groups trying to make inroads there. I would be surprised if one or more of these pass this fall, if there isn't a movement to do something about air quality.
And if I could, one of the things that the legislature's done in the past is they've tried to come in and cut the legs out from under these. We saw it with the Count My Vote thing. One of the most blatant examples was when Merrill Cook was running a term limits initiative, and the legislature came in, passed a term limits law, and then before the law that killed the initiative effectively, and then before the law took effect, they repealed the law. So no, it never actually had any impact. I think there's a chance we'll see the legislature try to do that this time. I think that would be a mistake, because it would be a pretty cynical move, and I think it would, when these people put all this time and effort and money into it, then to have it, torpedoed like that in sort of a surreptitious or, cynical way, I think would be damaging to the legislature and probably give more incentive to these people to run initiatives in the future.
It's Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune. Robert, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And David Magleby, professor of political science at Brigham Young University. His book is called Direct Legislation. Professor, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
And the professor mentioned educating people on these kinds of things. You should check out our podcast, 45 Days from KUER. It's a lot of educating going on in there, I think. So, Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Annie Lynn Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.